Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So all the talks I've given in this Vedic retreat has always been focused on the practice of the meditation. And part of that practice, it is calming the mind down, but it's also, as I repeat again and again, it's not using willpower but using the wisdom power. So let's just say instead of wisdom power, call it insight power. In other words, just seeing just how the mind works and using that faculty of wisdom through doing things like vimamsa investigation in order to understand what the blockages are, what the reason is that the mind is not getting peaceful. As I said last week, I believe, the two types of meditation, the meditation called Second Noble Truth Meditation, which means if you're craving, it leads to suffering, which means if the meditation is not working, if it's suffering, if it's frustration, it means you've been craving something. That's Second Noble Truth Meditation again. And the Third Noble Truth Meditation, if you let go, you get peace, you get freedom, you get a sense of happiness and piti sukha and stillness and even jhanas. But if you're getting those peaceful states of mind, that's called letting go. So straight away you can see this is developing a great deal of insight into the Four Noble Truths, number two and number three, which are really important. And this is not doing it just by thinking or by inference or by trying to work it all out. It is doing it for the direct experience of what happens in your meditation, which is why I like to call the meditation the laboratory of the Dhamma. It's where you do the main experiments to find out what the deep dhammas are. Sure enough, you know, in your daily life, in just the work you have to do, in the duties you have to perform, yes, you do gain some insight there if you're mindful and reflective enough. But I remember Ajahn Chah saying that those sort of defilements, you know, the ones which everybody knows about, you know, the lust, the anger, the jealousy, that's actually not the heart of the problem. Yeah, there are problems and they sort of create so much suffering. They're not like the underlying, the really deep defilements which stop one from becoming peaceful, which stop one becoming still, which stop one seeing things as they truly are, which stops the insight, which stops the enlightenment. Those are very, very refined defilements or cravings or attachments which stop the enlightenment experiences. So yeah, you know, we have to restrain those gross defilements, but there's the very fine ones. They're the ones which underlie everything. And those are the ones you really only meet when you're meditating. Which is why that, yeah, outside in the world, you know, you may not see these things, but when you come here and go on a retreat especially, it's a totally different ball game to what you experience out in life. When you have all the time by yourself, there is no place to escape to anymore. All you've got is your hut. You know, there's no TV, there's no internet to surf, there's nothing to do. And of course that's a really important place to put yourself in, where you put yourself in that situation of meditation. All you're doing is meditating, sitting, walking, there's no distractions or very limited distractions. It means you do have to face those very deep defilements of the deep attachments, which are the main ones which stop one getting enlightened, and those are the ones which one comes across in the laboratory of meditation. And so that as one is meditating, again, well, look, I mean, you should have enough insight now to know that willpower never works. You strive, you struggle, you put forth effort, and it never works. Why doesn't that work? Should be very clear. You have enough knowledge of the Dhamma, and the knowledge is a great way of developing the insight, because the knowledge actually gives you the framework. These are the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha had insight. He understood what he was talking about. So when you hear the Dhamma of the Buddha, to take it seriously. This is powerful stuff. And in the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, it also says that the suffering, what is it? Apiyehi sampayogo dukho, piyehi, vipayogo dukkha, yampi chana labhati tampi dukkhan, which at least Ajahn Bhamali knows, and hope few other people know, means that apiyehi sampayogo dukkho means, you know, that separating from what you like. In other words, you haven't got what you want, you haven't got what you like, what's dear to you. And it doesn't mean just in the five sense realm, it means even in the six sense realm. So if you are, say, even in nimitta and you haven't got the jhana yet, you know, this is suffering there because you're separated from what you want. And of course, you know, the apiyehi sampayogo dukkho is like association or being connected with what you don't like is suffering. And basically, yampi chana labhati tampi dukkhan. Just whatever you like, what you ever want, not having that, that is suffering. So it's all about this liking business and wanting business, this causes the suffering. And you know, there's very beautiful sayings in the Dhammacakka Sutta, in the definition of the Four Noble Truths. And when I first heard that, I took that on board. You know, that separation from what I want is suffering, and wanting something which I don't have is suffering. Just wanting anything is suffering. And so you look at your meditation, and you can see that any wanting at all is suffering. And where does the effort come from? For most people, what you think is effort is wanting. Yet it's striving, but it's underpinned by wanting something. You know, wanting to get deeper in meditation, wanting to get insight, wanting to get peaceful, wanting something. Now, it's that particular wanting is the suffering. You're separated from what you want. There's a gap between where you are and where you want to be. And that's the suffering. And the whole purpose of meditation is to lessen that gap until there's no gap at all. Where you want to be is where you are. And that's called contentment. So there is no separation from the light. There's no association from the dislike. And of course, what usually happens in most people's lives is a war which we fight. And it's a constant battle, you know, continued from the moment we're born and probably to the moment we die and afterwards as well, of course. And it's a war between, you know, what you want and what you have. And that space, that gap between, is like the two armies which fight each other and cause all the problems and suffering, the anger, frustration and pain and grief. You know, and what usually happens, you know, here I am, this is where I want to be. And what we really do there, we strive. Because when we strive, we want to move ourselves to where we want to be. We want to change our mind to be peaceful. We want to change our body to be healthy. We want to change our monastery to be perfect, whatever it is. And of course, that sort of that wanting is causing the suffering of life. It's craving. When we let go, we're not actually changing sort of ourselves. We're changing our wants. So I'm just happy to be here, wherever this happens to be. So actually, I don't change myself. I change the objects of my desire to be where I am. So there's no separation anymore. Where I am and where I want to be become exactly the same place. Now when you actually start practicing that, to let go of the craving, let go of the desire, to close that separation from where you are and where you want to be, so that gives you this marvelous insight. You start practicing like that, it's called letting go, and what it means is the mind becomes peaceful. Becomes peaceful because there's no work to be done. There's no separation from where you are and where you want to be. You know that what life is like, you know, we have these goals. And many of you had your goals, what you wanted to achieve in this retreat, what you wanted to achieve so far in life. And have you noticed that as soon as you reach one goal, you want another goal? And then another goal and another goal. You know, as soon as I got my O levels, I wanted my A levels. As soon as the A levels, a degree. As soon as the degree, you wanted something else. And then when you decide to let go of the world, you know, with girlfriends and money and career, then you wanted, you know, jhanas, then you wanted enlightenment. There's just more wanting. And there's always that sort of that goal somewhere in front of you. And you realize that that was the suffering of life. And they came, and many people do that. Sometimes you can get very far with striving. It's like a delusion. You think you really are getting somewhere. Yes, you put forth a lot of effort. Yes, you can sit for 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 hours. Marvelous. Don't worry about that. When you're dead, you can sit for much longer. And of course, you know, that's my little joke, but you know Ajahn Chah's famous story. You know, when people said how long you should sit meditation for, you know, to be a really good meditator and to get enlightened, you know, he said, look, it doesn't depend on the length of time you sit still. If it depended upon the length of time you sat still to become enlightened, he said, all the chickens in the world will be arahats by now because they sit for hours on their eggs without moving, much more than you could. So that was like chicken enlightenment when you decide to sit for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. You know, you're just going to be reborn as a chicken in your next life if you're not careful. So, okay, if it happens naturally, brilliant, well done. But you don't go setting out to beat the world record and get in the Guinness Book of Records for the longest meditation. That's not sort of what monastic life is all about, what Buddhism is all about. So instead of just going for all these goals, and hopefully this is important this time of the retreat, because most of you, if you had any goals, I hope and pray that you are frustrated by now. And I think that I'm confident that most of you are. Where's the problem? Is it you? You haven't been putting forth enough effort, you're not skillful enough, you're not smart enough. You know, a lot of times people blame themselves. You know, I was too lazy, I should have got up early, I should have put more effort in, or I should have been more skillful, I should have done this. No, it's not you're not the problem, it's the goal was the problem. It's wonderful to see that. So don't feel guilty and blame yourself, there's no one here to blame anyway. It's just setting these goals, that was a stupidity. And as I was saying to someone during one of their interviews, you know, it takes a lot of courage to have no goals. Because we fear, don't we? We fear if I don't set any goals, I'll just waste my time. Why are you afraid of wasting time? Sometimes, again, that's because of the ego. You've got goals, you've got cravings, you want to set standards, whatever. And so sometimes, now this is a dangerous teaching because you have to do this properly. When I say you can waste time, some people take advantage of that and just marvel twisted around to be defiled. But the real wasting of time is actually having just no goals, no time, waste the future, waste the past. So all you've got left is the present moment. This is why I love this present moment practice, because where can there be any desire? In the present moment you cannot be separated from what you want. Because what I want is somewhere in the future. I'm not associated with what I don't want, because what I don't want is always comparing that it must be worse than something I had before. It's incredible that just when all the perceptions of the past totally, 100% vanish, and all fantasies of the future also vanish, when you're just left with this moment, it's impossible to have any desires or wants. That's why just the focusing on the present moment is a beautiful way, a very effective way. It's not just the basis, it sort of encompasses just 99% of the path. Just being just here and not wanting, because you find if you want the nimitta or the jhana, you're just looking into the future. And you know, you don't even know what jhana is, so what are you wanting? You know, you're just wanting things which you've never heard about before. You know, just wanting things which you don't know if they really exist. You're wanting things which you don't really understand. Isn't that crazy? That's why the Buddha said that he gave the simile of the man who told all his friends he's going to marry the most beautiful girl in the whole of India. And his friends said, now who is this beautiful girl? What's her name? What's her clan? Is she tall? Is she short? Is she fair? Is she dark? He said, I don't know, but I want to marry the most beautiful girl. It's crazy, you don't know who you're marrying. Who is it? You know, it may be someone with AIDS or with his infectious diseases. Yeah, they may look beautiful, but you know, don't know what's going to happen next. So it's just absolutely stupid sometimes that, you know, the goals we have. So that simile of marrying the most beautiful girl in the whole of India, even though you don't know, you know, who she is or what she's like, it's like, I want the jhanas, I want the stream winning, I want the enlightenment, I want this. Do you really know what you want? What is it, this goal which you're aiming for? It becomes a bit stupid after a while. And it realizes you are just chasing ideas which you have no idea about. That was actually to me that, you know, in the early years, even the early years of being a Buddhist, you know, people ask me just, you know, what's the goal of Buddhism? You know, nirvana, nirvana. And they say, what is it? Well, actually, I don't know. And it was embarrassing because I realized I was getting on a bus whose destination I had no idea about. You would never do that. How many of you would go to the airport and get on an aircraft, you don't know where the aircraft is going to land? That's like many people who sort of get into Buddhism, aiming for all these things, and they don't really understand what these things are. So that is actually going for goals. And instead of going for goals, we just go for peace instead. Just for being here. And what we're really trying to do is actually overcoming that very thing which sets the goals. Overcoming that thing which creates the craving. Just letting go and seeing the source of all this craving, setting goals, wanting, not being happy here and thinking there's going to be something better in the future. That thing which we call life. Because that's what life really is. Life is just craving, reaching out for something new. So this is all about death. But the beautiful death, not the death of a body, but just the death of all craving, the end of samsara. It's a tough one to do. But you actually can start to experience it in the laboratory of meditation. So when I was meditating just last week, it was just, there's all these beautiful tricks to let go. They're using sort of, you know, the insights. And I was tired. So I thought, I just need to rest. But instead of laying down and going to sleep, I thought, what's the best way to rest? So sitting up, laying down, doesn't really matter what posture I'm in. What really is a rest for me is when I don't move my mind, when I don't go wanting things. So I just sat there and just rested the mind. Not sort of doing any business, not doing any jobs, no duties, not going anywhere, not being unhappy where I was. This is where I was, tired, sort of not particularly bright. I'm just going to be here. And of course, you know what happens when you do things like that. The mind gets incredible energy, beautiful, nimittous, the whole works, simply because you know how to rest. So to me, you know, all those deep meditations, they're places of rest. So when I'm tired, that's what you do, you rest. You rest the mind. And that actually really shows you that these are actually places where the craving stops. These aren't goals, because goals take a lot of hard work and striving. You know, you remember when people used to play sport. Yeah, they struggled so much, but they were worn out afterwards, panting and had to put their feet up. There's no rest because they had all these goals, fighting, running about, backwards and forwards. But in meditation, instead of going round and round, you know, like the athletes, or like those poor horses in the horse racing. I never liked horse racing, not only because, you know, those poor horses were being beaten all the time, but I couldn't see the point of it. You know, the horses, they finished up where they started. They went round and round and round, which is absolutely stupid. So, and that's actually, you know, the Olympic Games, just go round and round and round. So, you know, if that was me doing the Olympic Games, you know, I'd sort of, you know, when you start, you just get off the starting blocks and just wait for other people to come round and join them on the next lap. It makes a lot of sense. So the point is that, you know, all this rushing around, these goals which we set, that is a problem. And our insight, after a while, starts to see that. This is the craving. You say, what do we want? So that also becomes this little mantra which I use to develop the insight which creates the stillness. Sometimes in meditation it's not just resting, you ask yourself, what do I want? And then when I ask myself, what do I want? I say, is that really necessary? Do I really need that? And who wants it anyway? Do I really know what that's going to be like if I get it anyway? Is that going to be the end? Once I get that, do I want something more? And soon, actually, if you investigate this whole idea of wanting, You know, you realize it's just, it's promising things which will never deliver. You know, it is the con game, as I said last week, the dodgy brothers, this Australian idea of these second-hand car salesmen. They would sell you these old bombs, these wrecks of cars, as if they were just new or they were just a great bargain. Selling you things. Or just like that great simile of the Buddha, of the blind man who was sold an oily cloth by this con artist. And when a surgeon came and restored the man's sight, as soon as he could see, and he saw, "My God, I've been sold this oily cloth," and they said it was like a fine Gucci cloth or whatever, for a sash. And of course you get angry and upset. "I've been sold a dud." You know, that's what happens when you stop wanting things. Now this wanting is the dodgy brothers, it's the craving. You know, it's sort of, it's promising you things. And how many years have you lived with craving? And it's promised you all sorts of satisfaction, and it really hasn't delivered. You know, it's like it's unfaithful. So, you know, it promises you, once you get this, then I'll be okay. Then I'll be happy. You know, once I get sort of, you know, my retreat, then I'll be happy. I don't know, I'm looking forward to my retreat next week. It's stupid. Once I get my retreat, then I can really rest. No, come on, that's not... I'm not going to rest. You're going to rest, you're going to rest now. And some of you are on retreat. Only, how many days to go? I don't know, but even thinking like that, oh, when I finish retreat, then I can be doing all these things. Or when I get on retreat, then I can do all these things. You can see just that just creates these goals, these cravings, these wantings, which take you away from where you are into some fantasy realm. So it's more important just to let go of the craving, let go of the wanting, and have no wants. So I would ask myself, what do I want? If I get it, would I be happy? And just all the wants, they just vanished. And even you're sitting in your hut, you know, sometimes you're sitting in your hut and you don't want to meditate, and you don't want to walk, you don't want to read a book, you don't know what to do. So that's, you know, when I got to those stages, you know, of like frustration, restlessness, can't meditate, don't want to walk, don't want to read, done that, can't go to sleep, I slept enough. What am I going to do during this retreat time, you know, in the long hours of the afternoon or the evening? And I used to ask myself, what do I want? I started thinking what I wanted, and tick that off, scratch that out, until there was nothing else. And so I don't want anything. And by that time, I've become quite peaceful. Sometimes I just wanted to be somewhere else. And remember that saying which I gave about the simile of the prison? Wanting to be somewhere else is called a prison, is called a jail. So if you're meditating and you want to be somewhere else, if you're in this hall and you want to be outside, if you're outside and you want to be inside, that's called being in a prison. A prison is any place you don't want to be. And it's wonderful insight to have that, that sometimes you may be in a nimitta stage, a lot of piti sukha, blissed out. But you want to be in jhana. That makes it a prison. That's why you cannot make that transition from the nimitta into the jhanas. You don't want to be here. You want to be somewhere else. That is wanting. That is disturbing the stillness. That is stopping the build-up of samadhi enough to achieve the jhanas. Throughout the whole stage of meditation, you have to want to be here. Every moment, no matter what it is. You want to be somewhere else, prisons, suffering, busyness, disturbance, you're not allowing things to be still. But if you want to be here, whatever it is, and some of my life I've had to do that, you know, doing things which I don't like doing, you know, being in situations where I'm uncomfortable, being in painful situations, tired, whatever. But in those situations, I try to develop this. It doesn't matter, I want to be here. It's aching, it's painful, I'm tired. You know, I don't want to sort of talk to all these people. But no, I want to be here. And that way you feel this great sense of freedom. It's a lack of wanting, a lack of desire. And it gives these incredible insights. You know, just my life is totally out of control. you get invited here, invited there, doing this, doing that, people come and talk to you and whatever at all times, telephone calls come in, just, you know, from people just, I don't know why they were, just even this evening, a guy called up even from Europe, I don't even know him, and he just wanted to talk about, you know, should he tell his friend he doesn't like him. I mean, what do you want to ask me that for? But you know, what do? You know, when you know, you're at the end of a telephone call, which is totally ridiculous and stupid, but you know, I just want to be here. And if you want to be here, there's no suffering, and then you have this beautiful peace. Now that's what happens in the meditation, that's what happens in life. And I don't know how many of you got angry in the last week or shouted at somebody, if not maybe the last week, the last year or something. What was that all about? Why you got upset and angry at someone? Because, you know, you didn't want to be here. You wanted to change the person. You're having an unpleasant time. But that's part of our life, so we have just to want to be here. Not just with the happy part of life, but with the painful part of life. Not just be happy to be here with the pleasant experiences, but the unpleasant experiences as well. To be happy to be here, not only with the nimitta minds, but with the sloth and torpor mind as well. To be happy to be here, no matter what's happening. And you find if you can be content with the sloth and torpor mind as much as with the nimitta mind, it means you can be content when you get stupid phone calls as well as when, you know, you're just sitting there and just enjoying yourself. So this is the insight which one develops from the laboratory of meditation. Whatever works in meditation, you find works in life. Whatever works in life, you can work in meditation. It's letting go of desires and creating this beautiful sense of contentment, being happy to be here, no matter where that is. It's very weird then, and people ask you, you know, where do you think of going after the range retreat is finished? Oh, I haven't thought about that. I'm just happy to be here. Well, you know, what are you doing tomorrow? Don't know. I'm just happy to be here. Is there anything you want? No, I'm just happy to be here. It's a wonderful sense of contentment. Now, by overcoming those desires in that way, what is actually happening to you? That contentment creates a peace, which creates a stillness. Samadhi equals stillness. It's not concentration. The jhanas are very deep stillness. Nimittas are just that stage of still a bit of agitation, but not as still as the jhanas. You know, delightful breath, that's very still, but not as still as the nimittas. This is just the mind becoming more and more still. And this is just what happens. If you want something, you are going in the opposite direction. And for many people, the striving and the struggle is wanting something. So the effort will always be the effort to stop. Just like the Buddha said to Angulimala, stop, Angulimala. And of course, Angulimala was wise enough to know the deeper meaning of the word stop. It's one of the most beautiful words, to stop. Because we're always moving, physically, mentally, emotionally. And the idea just to stop is a great idea. So sometimes you can say that to yourself in meditation. Just stop. Just like that. And you continue it for much longer. It's beautiful to stop. What happens is the whole world stops. All the craving stops, all the movement stops, and then you have an idea what the Dhamma is. The Dhamma never sort of is seen in movement. It's only seen in stillness, in the stopping of craving, in the stopping of the outflowings of the mind, in the stopping of this search of the sense of self to attain things and to get things. Because sometimes you think, you know, what are you trying to attain anyway? Or rather, who's trying to attain it? Now, who wants things? You know, if they want something, who gets it anyway? But sometimes all the stuff which I've been doing, working really hard, and I don't get it. You know, you're supposed to, if you become a famous monk, you're supposed to get lots of requisites. I don't get them, you get them. You're supposed to get lots of money. I don't get it. Sort of the Buddhist society gets it. So, you know, I've got no money left. Never had any to begin with. And my requisites are very poor. So sometimes, you know, all this hard work which I do, I don't get anything out of it except just tiredness. So what's the whole point? I'm going to retire. I'm going to go on strike. And my strike starts on Tuesday when I go on retreat a couple of weeks. Sit down, protest. But the point is that in all this wanting business, where does it ever get you? So when I go on a retreat, I've got no goals. I'm not going to say, okay, Ajahn Brahm, you've got 15 days, first day, first jhana, second day, second jhana, third day, third jhana, fourth day, and then psychic powers, blah, blah, blah. And you tick off. No, tick off your... Because that's not how it works at all. And if I did that, all you'd ever get is a huge amount of suffering. So what I do when I go on retreat, I just stop and sit down there and do nothing. No goals. My job is to stop. So the effort is to put up these guards on the mind. I put up these two guards. One looks to the past. Stops anything from the past coming into the mind. And the other one looks to the future. Stops all the things from the future coming in. And it stops all this wanting. And if they notice, I want something, stop. You're just creating more suffering. So all this wanting creates the world. It was one very beautiful part of going to Dhammasara just a few days ago for the stupa ceremony. Was that they did this? Asked everyone to do this chant as we were commemorating or whatever it was, the stupas, putting the relics in, and that was the chant. I'd never seen this chanted before, and it was the chant of you know, the house builder. You know, the house builder. You are seen. You know, your gable is removed. You know, you're not going to build any more houses for the future, and that house builder is a craving. That's a build, the house of samsara, you know, the body, the mind, you, who you think you are. It built Ajahn Brahm, it built Ajahn Appi, it built Venerable Niroda, it built everybody in this monastery. Now, your gable. The gable was, you know, like the ridge piece, you know, which held all the other rafters together. Once that's removed, the whole house falls down, like the keystone of a bridge. The center which holds everything together, when that's removed, the whole thing just falls apart. You're removed. No more houses are going to be built. It's a beautiful thing to think about, even though today I've been spending most of my day building the teacher's cottage. But no, that's just doing my duties. But this is the inner builder, and it's beautiful to be able to chant that in Pali, and just those. Actually, I must admit that's the most inspiring. But it's also quite meaningful that there you were talking about this not building anything and we were just building two stupas. But, never mind, it's inspiring to do. But the whole idea of the deeper teaching was to actually stop building things. And you find all of your aspirations, that's all they do, they build things. They build material things, they build spiritual things, but still building, still going in the same direction, away from Nibbana, making more samsara, more places to be reborn into. And the very nice thing is when we don't build out of anything at all. We just totally, absolutely, 100% just let go. As I keep saying, if that letting go is happening, then you get very peaceful and still. Third Noble Truth Meditation. It means you get piti sukha, peace, still, close to Nibbana. That is called letting go. And if you think you're letting go and you're thinking about this, getting frustrated, that is not letting go. You're confusing letting go for craving. If it really is no effort, letting go, no not doing things, no stopping this will, if it really is that, that is Third Noble Truth Meditation. You are still, you get closer and closer to the experience of enlightenment here and now. Because that's what happens, it's stilling the mind. And this is how you gain the great insights of what it's like to be still and where that stillness comes from. You're learning just how to stop samsara, how to take off that gable, that ridge piece which holds the whole thing together. What is that ridge piece again? It's craving, it's will. Because when the will stops, then the mind stops too. This is where dependent origination becomes unraveled. When you are still, when you stop. Because when there's stopping, the will stops. That is the house builder. That is what creates the future. And this is what happens when you stop and are still. Things vanish. They disappear. Samsara starts to melt and vanish. And that's why it's a weird and wonderful experience to see things which were always so solid begin to disappear, to become impermanent, become fade away, they're just gone. That is one of the great meanings of anicca, of impermanence. It's not just rise and fall. As I often say in my retreats, it's very easy to see the waves on a lake go up, go down, rise and fall, rise and fall. That's superficial anicca. But when you see the whole lake vanish, with the hills, the mountains and the sky above vanish too, everything which held and encompassed that lake and the lake itself all vanished. No boundaries, nothing to define it. All gone. Now that is anicca. And that's what happens when you're still. When you're still, things vanish. And you're still because you've let go of all this wanting and craving and making goals. And you're actually seeing this and it's, wow, now that's insight, now that's amazing, that's wonderful. That's the sort of stuff which not many people see. Sitting here and your whole body vanishes. Sitting here and all your will vanishes. Seeing your mind starts to vanish. Wow, that's really weird. Because much of that has always been there for you. You know, there's part of you which, you know, is right here, right now, and which is here again the next moment, will be there tomorrow, which gives you the illusion of identity. It's the continuity delusion. Because it's always been there, just like this hall here. Because this hall has been here for, I don't know how many years, 25 years now, you know, you realize this is Bodhinyana Monastery. But imagine you came here this evening and the hall had vanished, and it wasn't here anymore. So where the heck has that hall gone to? Now that would be really interesting. Now that would be the stuff which will make you wise. And that's actually what it's like. It would be really strange and weird. But that's what it's like in the meditation. Solid things which you've been depending upon, relying upon, assuming are always there, suddenly vanish for reasons at first you can't fathom. And they really shake you. To see sort of the different reality that these things which you thought were solid aren't at all. And this is of course where one can truly learn how to let go. So what happens? It's just a path. You know, as you get still, things vanish. As you get things vanish, you realize they weren't mine anyway. So it makes it easier to be still. Why did I want all of these things which are a total waste of time anyway? Why do I want all of these things when I know they're just going to just create more suffering, they're going to fade away, I might as well let go of it now, the quicker the better. So that makes us be more and more and more of a renunciant, more and more of someone who just lets things disappear and go and vanish. I know that few people, not just one, but a few people were saying that when they listen to these talks, oh, they get very peaceful and very still. And is it because, you know, the tone of my voice, or is it because of, you know, the deep Dhamma? I know a lot of the reason is because while you're listening to the talk, you don't want anything. I'm satisfying your mind for 45 minutes or an hour. It's because you don't want. That is why you become still. Because you're satisfied. You're happy to be here. This is good enough. That's where that stillness comes from. Can you see that? That's called the insight. So now your job is, when you go back to your rooms, no talk, just by yourself, but just be totally happy to be here with this moment. And that's a skill which one develops in meditation. It's not the skill if you're just happy to be here with the pleasant or the interesting, or, you know, there's a nice talk going on. The skill is to be happy to be here, you know, even when you're cold and when you're tired, when you're weak with the sickness, when you're in pain, when you've got hay fever or stomach ache or backache or whatever. To learn that beautiful, happy to be here. And then you feel this great sense of freedom. You know, pain is a teacher, it's part of life. No one can avoid it, we all get our share. You know, when you're happy to be here, when you don't fight it, you're at least taking out the mental arrow of pain, and that's most of the pain gone. It's a beautiful thing to do, so happy to be here is less pain. That sounds like a good deal to me. So when you're happy to be here, and stop all this wanting to be somewhere else, happy yehi, sampa yogo dukho, vipa yehi, pi yehi, vipa yogo dukho, you change that around to api yehi sampa yogo sukho, pi yehi vipa yogo sukho, yampi chang labhati sukhang, or yampi chang na labhati sukhang should have been. So whatever you want, you don't get, you're still happy. Because you know that's part of life, and it's best that no wanting at all. And when you don't want anything, when you're happy to be here, you close that gap, where I am and where I want to be. And so there's no sankhara anymore, there's no craving, there's no war, there's no samsara. Samsara is the space between where you are and where you want to be. That's called the suffering. And when you stop that, close that gap, it's easy to close that gap. You don't have to wait until where you are is a beautiful place. You'll be waiting forever. Where you are, this is good enough right now. That's why that little mantra, this is good enough, this is good enough, this is good enough, it's a beautiful mantra. If you haven't done that yet, it's been taught many, many times, it's a great way of spending an afternoon. Sitting down, this is good enough. This is good enough. This is good enough. Whenever I do that, you start off with good enough, and actually it just grows. It's what I call bloody good. And it's brilliant. Ah, well, this is awesome. It all starts with, yeah, it's good enough. So it's not a sense of slacking off. This is the heart of the practice. This is using wisdom. It's using the insight which you have, I hope, from listening to all these talks, from reading the suttas, you know, from all the practice you've done. That insight should teach you how to be still. And sometimes I tell people that's a measure of your insight. I know many people who can write incredibly great books, and they can give talks much more inspiring than I can give. But it's all just words. And all the measure of insight is how still it can make you. If it's real insight, you really see what's going on, it means you can let go. You can just disassociate from all these defilements, cravings, attachments. If it's real insight, you're not carrying anything. So you're light and still. The side of insight will always be stillness. If you can't be still, if you're always doing so much, you know, especially in your meditation, if you can't sit still in your hearts but always restless, where is the insight? It's just superficial, it's just academic, it's not real insight. The sign of insight is how you can be still. So don't go for, you know, people who say smart things. Go for people who can sit still. Then you know, aha, that's insight. Who are happy and peaceful and happy to be here and content. That is insight. So you know it by its signs, not by its content. So this is actually how we use insight in our meditation practice. And all those years which I've been practicing, just people were asking me, was it today, I just think this morning, about wasn't Ajahn Chah fierce and scolding people? On reflection, he wasn't. He didn't scold me. He didn't sort of get angry at me or shout at me, I don't think ever. He was always very supportive and encouraging. And it was the kindness. Apparently when he was a young monk, yes, he was quite fierce. But I think that was just because he didn't realize just what needed to be done. Especially in his last teaching years, he was just very, very kind, very, very gentle and encouraging. Because that's actually the way that you use your mind. Be encouraging to your mind, be very gentle, and don't be so fault-finding to your mind. And that way that you have a beautiful teacher. And of course you are that teacher, you're teaching your mind how to be still, how to be wise. Enlightenment, Nibbana, you can have all these great ideas of what Nibbana is, and Amitajitta, the ground of all being, blah blah blah. Maybe that's a destination too far for you, but you all know what stillness is, to a degree. You always got some insight on what peace is, what contentment is, what freedom is. So work on things which you know, or at least you know you've got a good idea what they are. See how much stillness you can build up. Just how much sense of freedom, how much contentment. And yeah, you are going closer and closer to enlightenment, to Nibbana. And that's how you know it. So, I wish you all a happy abiding. I won't be giving a talk for another couple of weeks. But even though I'm not giving a talk, please know that I'll be practicing what I've taught all of you. Sitting in my cave, just blissing out, having a peaceful time. So next Wednesday, if you feel like listening to a talk, just go walk past a cave and see if you could get a blast of the energy. Because that's all you're going to get for the next couple of weeks. So I wish you all a very happy abiding. Very good. Oops. Thank you.